From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in your tax bill. Republicans in Congress are discussing a new tax plan, touting it as a big boost for the American middle class. Reviews of the tax plan find that most Americans would get at least some kind of tax cut next year if it passes. The bulk of the benefits appear to flow to the richest Americans. Now, Republicans have repeatedly argued against that analysis, calling it premature, unfair, or misinformed, and the president wants a bill on his desk soon. This hour, it's a chance to talk to a member of Congress, and we'll talk to others who have views of the possible impacts of these proposals. Let me go ahead and welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program, Congressman Tom Reed, a Republican. Welcome back, Congressman. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me on, Evan. It's always a pleasure.
In studio with me is Professor Ahmed Badabial, professor of economics at RIT. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And with us is Michael Kink, who is the executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. That's a progressive advocacy group. And where are you anyway, Mike? Are you in Albany?
I'm in New York City.
New York City.
Now,
I should know this. New York City.
All the benefits from the tax plan going to the billionaires down here. So
well,
that's where we're at today. Thanks
Michael,
for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. I know the congressman is likely to disagree, but let's start with this, Congressman Reed. I've read the reviews of this tax plan from Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation to the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center to the New York Times. Their conclusions are all roughly the same. It starts with this. The biggest benefits of the tax plan go to the wealthiest 1%, and in particular, there are big benefits for super wealthy people who don't have to work, essentially who own companies but don't have to run them. And I want to clarify one point, Congressman Reed. First of all, let's start there. Do you agree with the analysis from these various groups?
Absolutely not. What you're seeing is a manipulation of the data to carry out a political agenda. And as the individual from New York City just started the conversation with, highlighting that we're working to get billionaires taken care of, that just shows you that this is all political theater. And from my perspective, we're looking at real relief for hardworking taxpayers back home to the tune of $1,600 for the average family in my district, in our district alone.
$1,600, but let's say you had 10 taxpayers in your district and one of them got $91,000 in tax cuts, the other nine got $1,000. You could then claim that the average taxpayer in your district gets $10,000, even though 9 out of 10 get nowhere close to that. And that's what the Tax Policy Center says. They're pointing out that the average family in your district gets something like $300, not $1,600.
That's absolutely false. If you run the numbers and if you can do a rough calculation and you look at what we're doing with the new tax brackets, you look at how we're expanding the standard deduction, what I'm looking at is a typical family making around $40,000, which is somewhat the average salary in our district. That is the relief they'll see at the bottom line in their tax liability from last year's taxes to the future year's taxes once tax reform is enacted.
Do you agree with some of what we've heard from I would say from conservatives in general, which is that, number one, the wealthiest Americans, Tom, pay the most in taxes. So I've heard some conservatives argue that, well, yes, the richest get the biggest benefits because the richest pay the most in taxes. I'm curious to know why you don't simply just start there, agree with that, so we kind of have a starting point to understand the framework here. Do you agree with that?
Well, obviously, if you're saying $1,600 versus someone who's making $1 million and gets a reduction of $10,000, that individual gets more money in reduction. But relatively speaking, that $1,600 is a much larger portion of someone's individual earnings. And that's a lot of money from a day-to-day worker. I know the struggles these folks are facing. I lived it. Being with a single mother raising 12 kids, that's a lot of cash that can be used for purposes like taking care of family needs. And so from my perspective, if they want to engage in that argument dollar for dollar, I guess you can have that argument all day long. But the bottom line is we're lowering the rates, we're cleaning up the code, and the people that are going to benefit most from this are hardworking middle-class Americans. And that's what the numbers, when you run the forms, when you run the data, that's what it shows for our district.
But, Mr. Congressman, it was the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center that took a look at the House plan earlier this month. And so, again, you're saying $1,600 for the average family in that $40,000, roughly that kind of income level. According to the Tax Policy Center, if you're making anywhere from $25,000 to $48,600, the total average tax deduction would be $310, not $1,600. That if you're making
That's absolutely false because, when they ran those numbers, that was even before they knew where the tax brackets were, Evan. That's where they even knew where the rates were going to be at the end of the day. And so a lot of these, especially when you say a month ago, they were based on existing law versus new law. And so that's where this whole political theater and this manipulation is coming from. I trust people to do the math, to do their homework, to try- trust but verify. And I think at the end of the day, once they see this final tax reform enacted, they'll understand the numbers, and they're very capable of understanding the numbers themselves as opposed to relying on groups that are manipulating the data for their own political purposes.
How much should we expect the top 1% and the top 0.1% to benefit from this plan?
You know, as you saw, and I was an advocate for it, when you saw the 39.6 rate be placed on the books, and then you saw the bubble rate of 44% put on the books as part of the House tax proposal, I'm not fighting this fight for the wealthy 1%. I'm fighting this fight for the hardworking taxpayers. And when you see that type of rate, when you see that type of bubble effect, I think that should be a clear indication to all Americans what we're trying to do. It's not take care of the wealthy, not take care of the 1%. We're trying to give relief and target it to those hardworking Americans right in the middle. That's somewhere from in our area, from $50,000 to $75,000 on the low end, to $150,000 to $200,000 on the high end. Those are struggling Americans that are struggling paycheck to paycheck.
Why then is there, at least from what I've read in multiple places, provisions that benefit kind of passive business owners? And your colleagues on the left call this sort of the Eric Trump rule. You own a business, but someone else runs it. So often it's something you inherited from family. You know, you're probably super wealthy. You don't have to do much with it, but you're technically an owner, kind of a pass-through rule, as opposed to someone who owns it and works hard and labors or runs it. The tax plan, according to many sources, is harder on business owners who do work for their own companies as opposed to the Eric Trumps of the world. Is that wrong?
When you look at that, you know, obviously there's been a long-standing tradition. When you look at capital gains and you look at passive investment and pass-through entities by lowering the rates there, we're encouraging that investment. But at the same time, for those pass-through owners that are working day-to-day and struggling, that's why the reduction down to 25% for the pass-through entities is on the books to recognize at that lower pass-through amount, they're going to get a bigger return on their investment, and that's going to allow them, especially when you're talking about small businesses and what we did with small businesses, with the $75,000 of pass-through income being given a preferential rate of 9% on that return. That is a significant, for most of our mom-and-pop Main Street businesses, 9% versus the 30% that most of these folks are being taxed at is a significant reduction for those folks that are working in their businesses from a pass-through perspective.
The Congressional Budget Office says this bill would add $1.7 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. How are you going to pay for it?
Well, you know, this is where that was a hard decision to make. The $1.5 trillion is where the score ultimately came down to as we did the final work last week. And that's where the new score is when you update the information, Evan. And obviously, that's a significant amount added to the debt, and I'm concerned about that. But I do believe that one of the solutions to our debt problem is growth, and this is going to spur growth across the American economy. Get people back to work, create more jobs. Amazing how well the country can do once you have growth going on. But it also highlights the root cause of the problem, which is spending. And spending is driving our national debt crisis just as much as growth is going to be a solution to it. That's why we got to get the spending under control.
Congressman, when you talk about spurring growth, historically, I mean, if the tax rate is 90% and you cut it from 90 to 50, historically you've seen that can have an impact. But where the rates are now, anywhere up to 39.6 or 8%, we have not seen for the last three decades plus any evidence that tax cuts like this spur enough growth to come anywhere close to covering that sort of magical thinking. Why are we still doing that?
Well, I'm of the mindset if you grow the economy, obviously, long term, you're going to have significant growth for decades. And that is going to be a cornerstone or a piece of the solution. Doesn't mean it's the sole solution of the debt crisis or the $1.5 trillion that we're adding to the debt. But you are getting us on a path toward growth. And that's why you also have to have the conversation about what is driving the debt crisis, the spending side of the equation. And Evan, I'll offer one more thing, too. If people say that cutting taxes doesn't lead to growth, then I guess Governor Cuomo's economic development plans, where cutting taxes is the cornerstone of the Startup New York program, is false and should be disbanded and should be repealed in its entirety. But every governor, every state capital across the country has adhered to this policy. If you cut taxes, you cut regulations, that's what brings businesses to New York. That's what brings businesses to other states. And so if you disagree with that philosophy, then I guess all the economic development agencies out there are wrong also, too.
And maybe they are. I don't really sort of care about partisan back and forth. I care about what history has shown us and what the numbers have said for years.
And if you look at 1986, after the last time tax reform was done, That set the platform for long-term growth through the Clinton
years. And a huge deficit, and a huge deficit and national debt that has gone up since 1986, right?
I would say, no, if you look at 19 for the last 10 years, if you look at the $8 trillion that was put on the books over the last 10 years, that was primarily driven by spending, stimulus type of expansion, and easy monetary policy that has caused a tremendous amount of growth in the debt.
Congressman Bruce Bartlett helped run the Reagan Budget Office. He says you're wrong. He's a Republican. He says that for years, if you cut taxes in this way, there are going to be benefits for the people who pay less in taxes, but it doesn't come back to you in terms of revenue, and that if you want to keep doing that, it's more of an ideology. I guess what I'm asking you for is the
evidence. I guess I disagree with that, Evan, because every economic indicator and economist that I've seen, if you have growth, if you grow the economy from 2% to 4% to 3%, you're adding trillions of dollars of economic growth to the coffers. You're expanding the economy. That's going to lead to higher revenues going to the federal coffers as well as state and local coffers. And I've never seen an economist that said that growth does not help solve this problem in regards to revenue shortages that we see across the country.
About two more minutes. I know the congressman's schedule is tight. He is always generous with his time. When it comes to spending cuts, as you said, that's important. And I know your party finds that to be very important if you want to get some balance here. Some of the biggest forms of spending in our country outside of the military, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, are you going to target those?
Well, you know, obviously, we have been a supporter of Medicaid reform, for example, just as recently as the recent health care debate. We need to get Medicaid going in the right direction. We need to reward efficiency and quality as opposed to a fee-for-service type model. And that type of health care conversation, I think, would take care of a lot in regards to Medicaid and Medicare spending. And I think a lot of people would agree. You know, if you can align the interests so that you're rewarding efficiency and quality, I think most Americans would say, that makes sense. Let's do that. And that's hopefully where we can go as we get into the conversation of Medicare, Medicaid, and health care spending overall in America.
How much do you think this plan benefits the president and his family?
I don't think that is the priority, nor is it demonstrated in the facts. When you put the 39.6, the bubble rate, and the 1% paying a little bit more in particular, I would think that we're not talking about any type of benefit for the president or his family. We're talking about giving relief to hardworking people back home that $1,600 represents.
Is the bill going to pass this year?
I believe it is. I think we're very optimistic. It looks good in the House this week. Senate's moving forward. I think we're going to get this to the president's desk and signed into law before the January 1st deadline that we're trying to work towards.
And I know, Mr. Congressman, you understand the reason I'm asking these questions is because part of the reason this president got elected is hardworking people, many of them who've struggled to find work or find work that equals what they used to make before they lost work, many of the folks in your district voted for him because they want to believe the focus is going to be on the working class. That's what your party has sold with this bill, and we're going to have to see if it comes out that way. You're saying that it will, so we will follow that, and I hope we can stay in touch on this because I know it's important to your district.
We know we will, and I appreciate it. And I firmly believe that's going to be the outcome, and that's good for everybody in America as well as the world.
Congressman Tom Reed, a Republican representing a New York 23rd Congressional District. Thanks for the time, and we'll talk to you again soon, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
That's Congressman Tom Reed. We appreciate that. Listeners, you've heard from the congressman. We're talking about the GOP tax plan. And in studio with us for the remainder of the hour is Professor Amit Badabial, a professor of economics at RIT. And on the line with us in New York City is Michael Kink, the executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Michael, you know, the congressman said that a lot of that early analysis missed some either the evolution of what the GOP has done with this tax plan or was sort of premature in its reporting, and that he's claiming that all of the nonpartisan analysis that I was citing is wrong. So let's start with you. What did you make of that?
I'm afraid that the congressman is engaging in some of that magical thinking that you were talking about. You know, if Congressman Reed and his colleagues wanted to pass a tax cut for the middle class, they could. If they wanted to pass a tax cut that helped small businesses, they could. That's not the bill that America is looking at today. The bill that is in front of Congress, that Congressman Reed and Congressman Collins and Katko and Tenney and Faso and the other Republicans in the New York House delegation will be voting on Thursday, gives the biggest benefits to billionaires in Manhattan, on Wall Street and on Park Avenue. The benefits to working class and middle class people are small. A quarter of New Yorkers will see a tax increase. Everybody will be set up for cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, as you were suggesting, because they're blowing open deficits under this plan, and they're specifically targeting health care. We can go into the details of the plan, but the bulk of the money goes to the super rich and to multinational corporations. $1 trillion in benefits to the multinational corporations, many of whom are the biggest donors to Congressman Reid and his colleagues. The specific angles of the benefit to the corporations, the pass-through benefit that would help hedge fund and private equity managers. I mean, you could cap that. If you're really talking about a small business, an auto repair shop, or a small manufacturing plant, you could cap the benefit. But the biggest benefits are going to go to the richest people. They're eliminating the estate tax for the heirs and heiresses of billion-dollar fortunes. Again, you know, almost all the billionaires live in New York City on the Upper East Side. They live out in the Hamptons in their compounds. We're not talking about people that are well off, that have built a small business into a successful enterprise. We're talking about the bankers, the hedge fund managers, the people with $100 million apartments. Those folks are getting the vast amount of the benefits. And as you suggested, right, people like Trump and his kids, people that are passive owners of real estate investment trusts, kind of the sort of corporations and shell companies, will get the biggest benefit from the corporate tax breaks. So I think it's fair to confront Congressman Reid and other folks in his situation about the details of this plan. You're right on the facts. The massive benefits go to the very richest. Regular people, in many cases, will see a tax increase from the loss of the deduction for state and local taxes, from the loss of deductions for student loans, for care for disabled relatives and kids. And all of us are going to be at the threat for sharp cuts to health care, to Social Security, to safety net programs once they get done with this giveaway to the rich. Yeah, that's why we're building a statewide campaign to fight this. And we think it's possible to fight it and stop it, just like we stopped the health care efforts earlier this year.
I want to turn to Professor Amit Badabial and let our listeners know, as we talk about the GOP tax plan, you know, you can let us know what you think about what you just heard from Congressman Tom Reid. You can let us know your thoughts on and what you've read and what you've seen out there for this kind of a plan. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm going to turn to Professor Badabial for some response in general to what you heard, and maybe on the history of it. You know, you're the professor. I'm often the student here. I was trying to go just by the history, just by the evidence. That's why I cited people like Bruce Bartlett in the Reagan White House who have kind of come around to say just cutting taxes doesn't spur growth, you know, sort of automatically. And that is seems to be a peg in the stool of what the GOP is counting on for this to be paid for.
Right. So I would say that most of what you said and most of what Michael in New York City is saying is essentially accurate in terms of what people, at least serious people who are reading the nonpartisan analysis of the tax plan, particularly the House tax plan, have basically said. It is true that middle class folks will get some benefits, at least some people will get some benefits. But the fact of the matter remains that the disproportionate amount of the benefits are skewed in the direction of wealthy and very wealthy people. And the elimination of the estate tax has already been mentioned, which benefits a minuscule of the American population, but they stand to gain big time from the elimination of the estate tax. The alternative minimum tax is also being done away with. This was another tax that tried to keep relatively wealthy people from doing away with their tax liabilities. That's being scrapped. And I don't like a whole lot the way in which the corporate tax reduction is being handled. I mean, it is true that in principle, the corporate tax rate needs to be altered. That's true. But once we get past that principle into the specific details about how it ought to be done, I find several aspects of the current GOP plan to be problematic.
And you're talking about going from 35 to 20?
That's right.
In the corporate tax rate?
That's
so,
right.
So what are some of the red flags for you there?
Well, the biggest red flag for me is the following. Yes, it's true that we pay 30, well, corporations pay 35%. And that number in and of itself is significantly lower than the corresponding number in many of the other G8 countries. But the fact of the matter is not what the actual number is, what the effective payment rate ends up being. So some of the biggest corporations are able to hire very skilled accountants and lawyers and minimize their tax liabilities to the extent possible. So I remember seeing a study last year in 2016, which said, and it was credible as far as I'm concerned, that the effective payment rate is closer to 19 to 20%. So even though the actual nominal rate is 35%, what these giant corporations end up paying is closer to 19 to 20%. And that's very much consistent with the tax rates that are currently applicable in other countries, for instance, Great Britain. And when you add to that this idea that you're always going to have the very large corporations most able, as we have seen from
to dodge and get around.
Exactly, to avoid taxes legally. You really have to wonder, is this the best way that they could have come up with to deal with a problem, which definitely is a problem to a certain extent?
Okay, and before I take some phone calls, because our phones are lit up on this, let me just ask Michael Kink what I also asked the congressman, which is this. I have heard some conservatives, and we probably have some listeners who feel, and I can intellectually understand this, that the wealthiest Americans pay the most in taxes. So sure, the GOP tax plan is going to benefit the wealthiest or the super rich the most because they're already paying the most. I frankly, Michael, don't understand why the congressman didn't just sort of say that, because, again, all of the analysis I've seen indicates that's what will happen, unless, as he said today, that was all premature and wrongly reported. And I guess we'll find out in the coming days. But I have heard that argued in other quarters, not from the congressman today. And Michael, let me put that argument to you. Your conservative friends will say, I'm sorry, Michael Kink, but I'm paying the most in taxes already. I should get the biggest tax cut. What's wrong with that?
I think the congressman dodged the question because most Americans think the wealthy should pay their fair share. Most Americans believe in progressive taxation, where if you make more money, you should pay a little bit more. And most Americans think we should be closing loopholes rather than opening up new ones. The principle of progressive taxation makes for a stronger, better economy. It allows us to invest in public goods. I work with a group called the Patriotic Millionaire. So there are millionaires that think that millionaires should pay a little bit more in taxes. And our economy, the American economy, has done best when we've had a more progressive tax system and investments in public goods. Now, Congressman Reid's tax plan blows a huge hole in the deficit. I could think of ways to spend $1.5 trillion that would create millions of jobs, that could get us off of dirty fossil fuels and create clean energy everywhere around the country, rebuilding our infrastructure, putting a lot of those folks that you talked about who put their jobs, who lost better jobs and had to take lousier jobs, put them back to work in good paying jobs, right? But this tax plan is nothing more than a giveaway to the rich, and it actually includes new incentives to outsource American jobs with the way that it treats the tax rate on foreign profits. So I am happy to defend the principle of progressive taxation. I think right now the billionaires on Park Avenue and their kids have more money than they know what to do with. I think if you look at the balance sheets of American corporations, you'll see hundreds of billions of dollars already on the balance sheets just sitting around. They're not investing in factories. They're not investing in jobs. And the idea that if we shower more cash on them, they're going to do something that they're not doing now is ridiculous. We should be stopping this tax proposal just like we stopped the plans to blow up our healthcare system.
But Michael,
we should be working towards something that would benefit everybody instead of just the rich.
Then let our listeners know, what should the top line rate be? If you're in the top 1% or the top 0.1%, what should your tax rate
be? Well, you mentioned, and I would love to hear the professor's perspective on this, the American economy had the broadest shared prosperity and the most employment across all social classes when our top tax rate was 90%, right? The 50s and the early 60s were boom times. There were a lot of different reasons for that. But our country worked very effectively with a very high tax rate. I am not necessarily in favor of confiscatory tax rates. I'm not saying that we should go all the way back to 90%. But I think if President Trump or some future president or Congressman Reid and some future congressman or congresswoman put forward a plan that asks the wealthy to pay more than they're paying now, to invest in people, to invest in jobs, to invest in education and infrastructure and clean energy in a way that would pay off over time, I think most New Yorkers and most Americans would take that plan and they would support it.
You want to respond to some of that, Professor, and then we'll get to our phone calls in our second half. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. A lot of that makes sense from my perspective. And what I would like to point out to complement this discussion that we're already having is that the fact that it will add to the deficit to the extent of $1.7 trillion is something that really bothers me.
He says 1.5 now, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he can say whatever he wants, but all the numbers I've seen is essentially 1.7.
Okay.
But be that as it may, the fact of the matter is Republicans love to shout loudly about the deficit when a Democrat is in the White House. But when their own plans contribute to, and in some cases substantially enlarge the deficit, there's much less quiet about it. And what I find somewhat almost offensive is the attempt by certain members of the GOP party to hunt around for different groups of economists to see who can come up with the most favorable assessment of the current plan, particularly from a dynamic perspective. And then they want to argue that respected XYZ economist says that, you know, our plan will in fact not contribute to the deficit to the way a lot of our critics are saying. And in fact, it has many significant positives, which simply have not been taken into account by our opponents. That's just not true. We have to understand that the House plan, particularly the Senate plan, isn't quite as draconian, but we don't know what will emerge in conference. It definitely contributes to the deficit. Just come right out and say it and say that we have no reasonable way to stop or fill that gap.
He essentially did that while saying that, yes, he says 1.5, not $1.7 trillion over the next decade, but with a faith that the tax cuts will fill some or a good portion of that hole with just growth.
Yeah, but then he then goes on to say that, you know, we want to grow our economy. Since the Reagan tax cuts, we've had positive impacts on our economy. It is true that if you get growth, that will definitely contribute positively to the economy and people in general will benefit. But what he doesn't show is that the tax cuts that he and many of his party are proposing will in fact generate the kind of growth that he would like to see. That's the nebulous connection which they don't want to talk about. What they want to say is, how can you be opposed to growth? Well, nobody's opposed to growth. What people are opposed to is not being able to show a very credible connection between your tax cuts and the growth that you claim that these deductions will in fact give rise to.
And let me just make one other comment here. And I know Michael wants to jump in. We've got to get to your phone calls, but understand something else here. We now have a national debt that Republicans harp on all the time, past $20 trillion when they talk about the deficit. What Congressman Tom Reed was talking about was $1.5 trillion in deficits based on this tax plan alone that he thinks can be roughly filled with spending cuts and growth. And that would just get us to break even. If the GOP was more serious about actually eating into that debt, as they often say they are, they would have to do something dramatically different than this. So the goal, if they were serious about the debt and the deficit, would not be to break even. It'd be to cut into it significantly somehow. They don't put forth any plan to do that. They do make it a campaign issue and part of an attack at every seemingly opportunity. It's just interesting on the policy side, they don't really do anything to address it. But that's
and if they were targeting growth, you know, they could come up with a plan that boosted the economy from the middle class out, right? We could have a modest tax reform that actually provided real benefit to lower income and middle class families that spend most of what they get, that could drive growth, and fairer taxes on the rich and multinational corporations that provided an investment in things like infrastructure and public education. We could grow this economy. There is room for growth. But the formula for doing that is not showering cash on billionaires and corporations that already have more money than they know what to do with productively.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your phone calls, questions, emails, and comments right here. We're talking to Michael Kink, the executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition, a progressive advocacy group. He's coming to us from New York City. And Amit Badabial is a professor of economics at RIT, the Arthur Gosnell professor of economics at RIT. We had a chance earlier this hour to talk to Republican Congressman Tom Reed about the GOP tax plan. We're coming right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, John Nance, the author of the book Why Hospitals Should Fly, joins us. He takes a look at how medical systems can change to cut down on mistakes, to make patients' lives safer in the hospital, to make it more efficient, and to make it easier for staffs to occasionally challenge those who do make mistakes. We're going to talk to John Nance about improving our medical systems next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Anne in Rochester, first on the phone. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi. I agree with everything that's been said about better breaks for the wealthy and so forth. But one thing I haven't heard about is on Vox.com, they mentioned that there would be taxes on graduate student stipends and stipends and the tuition breaks that we give to our STEM graduate students. And that would actually have a big impact on education, as well as for us at University of Rochester, we would not be able to take as many graduate students if these taxes were, because we'd have to pay those taxes for the tuition breaks that they get, and we would be let, and many graduate students would go overseas for their graduate work. So anyway, in addition to having bad effects on the economy and in creating a bigger deficit, it would also hurt higher education. And I was just curious if that provision is still in the bill.
And thank you for the phone call. Let me first read a statement from the University of Rochester on the GOP tax proposal, and then I will turn to our guests, because that's what I happen to have in front of me. From the University of Rochester, quote, "The proposed legislation would eliminate or consolidate a number of tax deductions and provisions that offset the costs of higher education for students and their families, impact charitable giving, and increase costs for colleges and universities. These include elimination of several student-centered provisions, such as employer-provided educational assistance and the student loan interest deduction, elimination of access to the tax-exempt bonds that provide discounted financing for our classrooms, research labs, and patient care facilities, and an excise tax on some nonprofit private university endowments," end quote. So that's from the University of Rochester. Professor Badabial, response to Anne there?
Yeah, I haven't seen what the most current version of the bills are with respect to these specific educational taxation issues. But the caller, Anne, is absolutely right that if these deductions were in fact to disappear, then they would adversely affect not only students, but to a certain extent, university administrators also, who would have to now pay these taxes. But before we leave, can I make a point about the growth?
Yeah, and I know Mike is going to jump in there too, but go ahead.
Okay, so the argument that many GOP colleagues make is that, you know, these tax cuts are going to lead to economic growth, and growth is going to solve the problem by plugging in all, or if not a significant portion, of the $1.7 trillion difference that it's going to make to the deficit. But, you know, I've seen some reports from GOP analysts which say things like, because we're going to cut the corporate tax rate, this reduced corporate tax rate is going to allow corporations who now have this extra money with them to actually give higher bonuses or higher salaries to the extent of $3,000 to $4,000 per employee. And that's going to be a bonanza for these employees, because in addition to the cuts that they're already getting as individuals, they're also going to get wage increases of some sort or the other, and that this will spur growth. Now, this is a fairy tale as far as I'm concerned. I am unaware of any evidence at all which suggests that something like this is likely to A, come to pass, B, even if it were to come to pass, will in fact lead to the kind of growth that Congressman Reed earlier suggested that it would, and many of his colleagues in the GOP think it would.
And by the way, I quoted Bruce Bartlett earlier Bruce Bartlett is the author of a book called The Truth Matters. He was an economic policy advisor for President Reagan and President George H.W. Bush. He's a Republican, and now he says he tries to debunk the myth that he helped create. He told Marketplace.org, quote, "The biggest Republican tax myth is that we had vast prosperity in the 1980s that dwarfed the growth in any other time period, and that was totally and exclusively result of the 1981 tax cut." And Bartlett says, quote, "This is just total mythology. Real economic growth in the 1980s was less than it was in the 1970s or the 1990s, end quote. He goes on to tell Marketplace, and he wrote in his book, that simply cutting taxes does not magically lead to growth, and we need to retire this thinking. Historically, does that line up with what the evidence has shown you, Professor?
Yes, what I am aware of, it absolutely does.
Okay, Michael Kink, Ann was calling about the impact on grad students, students at university level. Thoughts on that?
Ann is 100% right. Those provisions are still in the bill. Congressman Reed and Congressman Collins and the other members of the delegation will be voting on it on Thursday. It's part of why we're working with university professors and students to urge them to vote no. It's a threat to higher education. It's a threat to those students. But it's also, when you look at the fairness angles, right, there's a particularly ridiculous idea behind taking the kids of like janitors and administrative assistants who are going to school, you know, their parents work at the university, their kids might be able to get in and get a tuition benefit, and taxing those lower income families on the full cost of the tuition. While you're giving huge tax cuts to billionaire kids on Park Avenue, that fairness part is particularly egregious to me. So the higher education threat is still in there. And to the professor's point and Bruce Bartlett's point, right, if you focus on fairness, you will come up with better public policy. If you look at ways to boost the middle class, the working class, lower income Americans, and provide them tools to move forward. If you're going to give tax breaks, give them to people that spend every dollar that they have. The rich and the big corporations are doing extraordinarily well. And our state has the worst income inequality of anywhere in the country. This bill would make that even worse. And it would hurt our economy rather than help it. I think if you focus on fairness, you're on the right track to better public policy.
Tom in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Obviously, I'm in the minority compared to the panelists. I've never heard you so animated when you were talking to the congressman. What doesn't get brought up in all of this is that there are so many taxes paid by upper middle people, such as every month I pay an additional $405.50 for my Medicare. And people tell me that's crazy. I don't, but I do, as does my wife. So that's over $900 a month to make the Medicare program grow. I do not get to deduct all of my charitable deductions nor mortgage interest if I had one. There are a million ways that taxes fall upon the rich to benefit the poor, and that is fine. And if you were to ask these people that have $1,600 more to spend on things that they desperately need, I'm sure that they would all be ecstatic. The problem is that it's always them or us instead of how about tax reduction benefits everybody. There's nothing wrong with that. Corporations employ more people. More people pay taxes. More people can buy ground beef instead of dog food, whatever you want to talk about. So that's my angst on the whole thing,
Tom,
is that it's always boils down to politics.
Okay, so Tom, please stand.
Dr. K said, for the good of the masses.
All right, can you stay on the line, Tom? Can you stay there? I'm glad you called. I don't think a whole lot of people are eating dog food, but I do understand the point you're making. What I want to say is a couple of things, and then I'm going to turn it over to our guests. You did hear me get animated with the congressman, and I want to tell you why here. I am not animated from an ideological point of view here. In fact, I have several times on this program tried to represent what I think is an intellectually honest viewpoint, which is that the bulk of taxes in this country are paid by the wealthiest people. And if you want to argue, then of course they should get the biggest benefits. That's fine. Every analysis I've read of the GOP tax plans indicate that the vast majority of benefits are going to go to the wealthiest. And I think you ought to just say that and just say, well, they're paying the most taxes. They should get the most benefits. And if you can start from an intellectually honest point of view right there, and then others may disagree with who should get the benefit, but if you want to start there, start there. I've heard that argued. Intellectually, it makes sense. Doesn't matter if I agree or not with it. I don't understand why the congressman wouldn't say something like that unless he's right, which is that all of these analyses are wrong and that the bulk of the benefits is actually going to the middle class and that it's just been misreported and misanalyzed by almost everyone who's taken a look at it. So there's that. I get a little exhausted when we sort of have to go round and round on the evidence. Then when it comes to the evidence, I understand your viewpoint that cutting taxes is good for everybody, no matter who's getting the tax cut, because maybe you hire more workers, or maybe you can spend more to invest and expand a company. Maybe workers have more in their pocket. They spend more into the economy. What I want to know is how much of that comes to pass and how much of that is sort of fanciful thinking that isn't borne out. Now, I don't necessarily think that we can argue for a 95% tax rate here without devastating effects on the economy. But to say that any tax cut magically leads to this boost, that's what the professor has been saying. Amit Badabial is not here from a partisan perspective. He's here looking at history, something he has expertise in. So why don't you start, Amit, and then we'll turn to Michael Kink. And I'm glad Tom's there. We can have a little discussion here. What would you say to Tom?
Well, I would say to Tom that the issue isn't whether you can find some middle class or some lower class, for lack of better terminology, poor folks who might benefit from the GOP tax plan. You always can, and there will always be some numbers. But the issue isn't that. The issue is who benefits disproportionately, and I repeat, disproportionately from these proposed tax cuts. And the answer has to be, from all the evidence that I've seen, that the wealthy to the super wealthy are the ones who disproportionately benefit from this kind of tax cut. There are people in other segments of the income spectrum that benefit. But the question is, do they benefit by as much as the wealthy are benefiting? And even if you were to take the position that you just mentioned, Evan, a minute ago, sure, that why don't we say that, okay, the wealthy pay the largest portion of taxes, so why not focus on the benefits on them? There are hidden behind that kind of logic certain basic issues concerning fairness. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, well, how did the wealthy accumulate their wealth? Did they just inherit a lot of wealth and did really nothing, for whom the repeal of the estate tax is going to be an additional bonanza? Or did they really work hard to create something out of nothing? So those issues related to fairness are also important to consider. And the final point that I'll make is that we live in an era of globalization. As Thomas Piketty has made very well known in his thorough and exhaustive analysis of capital and the behavior of capital in the present century, we have a tremendous amount of existing inequality, not only on the metric of income, but also on the metric of wealth. And we have to keep this in mind when we move forward in terms of the new proposals that we try to bring forward, so that we don't exacerbate the existing inequality, which is also already fairly extreme.
But Amit, not everybody is like the current Trump family, which is to say was born into a ton of money without doing a thing. Some people worked very hard to build from nothing.
That's right. That's right. So since we don't have the ability to separate, okay, you are meritorious, wealthy individual number one, but you, wealthy individual number two, are not meritorious, and we typically don't engage in that kind of fine
distinction, right.
That's why we talk about the super wealthy and wealthy as a group.
Okay. Okay. So that let Michael Kink, some thoughts there, and I got to take more calls, but go ahead.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I agree with Tom. $1,600 would make a huge difference to a lot of families in New York and everywhere else around the country. But I also agree with the professor. The question is, what's the tax plan you're putting together? What's the public policy you're putting together? If you wanted to construct a tax plan that gave some help to everybody, you could do that. That's not the tax plan we have on the table. The tax plan we have on the table, you know, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, gives a couple of $100 to regular working people and enough to buy a new Mercedes every year to the richest
1%. $178,000 for the top 0.1%, $38,000 for the top 1%. And yeah, roughly $310 if you're making between $25,000 and $48,000.
Exactly. And if you concentrate on that top 1% of the 1%, that is where all the money is going. And I swear to God, I think most of us, whether you're left, right, or in the middle, if you're working around Rochester, if you're working around the Hudson Valley, if you're working around the Adirondacks, there is nobody in the billionaire class up there. Tom Golisano was the only one, and he moved to Florida. All the benefit from this bill is going to Manhattan multimillionaires and billionaires and their heirs and heiresses. And that's the thing that I think people across the spectrum could be angry about. There's a lot of legitimate anger out there, and some of it should be directed at this unfair tax plan.
All right, Tom, quick follow-up. Go ahead, sir.
No, I would just say, so let's close some of those loopholes for the top 1%. But the top 1% creates an awful lot of wealth with things that they do. But yes, there are too many advantages for them. So start to tax carried interest and stuff. See, no Republican or Democrat would try and publicly, honestly defend like exempting or capital gains tax on carry interest. Close the loopholes, as one of the gentlemen said.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tom, thanks for the phone call.
Amen. And, that loophole is left wide open in this bill. I totally agree with Tom. Okay. Donald Trump campaigned on it last year.
That's
he
true.
Said he'd close it, and they're keeping it wide open.
That's
Professor,
true.
Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay. Back to the phones. This is Don in Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
You know, I'm not really understanding why you're getting bogged down in all this extraneous information, like how people acquired their wealth and that kind of thing. That has nothing to do with taxes. We should just focus on a tax rate, a flat tax rate, because you guys on the panel can't even agree on how people should be taxed. You certainly agree that all rich people should be taxed, but that's why we need to take politics out of taxation and just have a flat tax. Everyone pays the same percentage. That's it.
Don, thanks for the phone call. Professor Badabiel.
Well, that's one particular perspective.
Sure.
And, there are some positives associated with it. But then again, the bigger question becomes, what is the objective of tax reform? Once we answer that particular question, then we can look at subsequent issues about how many tax brackets there should be, who should pay how much, and those kinds of things. So this is one particular approach, the flat tax. I mean, it has been sold by several people as being fair, and everybody pays basically an equal percentage of his or her income. And there are some positives to it, but I still definitely have a preference for a tax plan that is broadly progressive, and that eliminates loopholes to the extent possible so that the very wealthy who are able to typically hire the best accountants and lawyers are unable to avoid tax to the extent that they currently can.
All right, Michael, make it simple. Everyone pays the same tax rate. Why not?
I mean, if you're a billionaire, a flat tax is great for you. Anybody else, it would be really, really bad. I think the hedge fund manager that owns hundreds of millions of dollars in shares of McDonald's should pay a higher tax rate than the woman that flips and cooks the burgers. I think if you make more, you should pay more. I think that is a good way to do tax policy. I think it's a reflection of the values that most Americans share. And I think it's a solid, substantial way to fund the public services that everybody needs and benefits from. The people that run huge multinational corporations need public education. They need a power grid. They need clean energy and a clean environment. They need a legal structure that allows them to do their business in a way that's reliable. All these things require public investments. And a flat tax is, frankly, for suckers unless you're a billionaire. The fair way to do it is as you earn more, you pay more, and that we're asking the people that benefit the most from the economy, from all of our collective effort, to pay a little bit more. I'm not talking about taking all their money away. I'm talking about doing it in a way that's fair that most Americans would agree with.
I think the people like Tom or Don who call might fear that you're not going to stop. If Michael Kink were in charge of tax policy, you'd move that needle toward 90%. Would you stop it?
Well, I think one of the problems we have here is that our public policy has not caught up with the explosive inequality that we have in our economy. If you look at all the gains, if you look at all the benefits since the economic collapse in 2007 and 2008, it's all gone to the very top, and almost all of it has gone to the very top of the very top. So we have these tax rates and tax plans that were set up in the 70s and 80s that reflect the distribution of income that we had back then, when there just wasn't the explosive inequality and all the gains we've seen by the billionaire class.
All right.
I think most regular people should be treated better, and I think the billionaires should pay more than they're paying now.
Michael Kink, Executive Director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Online where, Michael?
Strongforall.org, and my Twitter feed, @mkink. I'll post a lot of the details you were talking about.
They're a progressive advocacy group. We appreciate Congressman Tom Reed's time. We invited him for the entire hour. He is always welcome. All members of Congress can have a seat at this table whenever they like. Could only give us 20 minutes today, but that's generous of his time. We appreciate that. Our thanks to Amit Banabiel, professor of economics at RIT. Always good, Amit. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.